Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 2, The Nightlands. I would have guessed this title was one word. I keep thinking of it as one word in my head. It's two words, The Nightlands. Where does it land?
Somewhere at night.
Yeah.
It wouldn't make any damn sense if it did. If the Nightland shows up, if Nightland lands at high noon, this is mm-hmm. like a Woodchuck, Kudchuck situation. And this is not a BoJack Horseman Season 4 podcast, so we'll just move past that. Are you asking me what I thought of it?
I am, yeah. Oh. Indirectly. Very, very indirectly.
It's good. It's good. It's not like, a super impressive episode. It's not like
what?
A statement episode.
Okay,
but
yeah.
That's what I meant. Like, it's not... But it continues to develop the political intrigue of Tyrion trying to clean up his sister and his family's mess in King's Landing. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, as much as we like Tyrion and think he's clever, we see that there's other clever people that are a danger to him. And we continue to see Jon pierce the intrigue up at Craster's Keep
mm-hmm.
and get him into some moral quandaries. And then Theon...
Ooh, oh boy,
Theon. Theon's the op. Theon is a very unqualified emissary, and his father and sister play him like a goddamn fiddle.
Yeah,
and he goes in thinking one thing and comes out and finds out it's the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure tragedy is going to ensue. What do you think?
I really like this episode. To me, this is one of like. This is the defining tone, I think, of early Game of Thrones for
yeah.
me. There are so many scenes in this episode of people with incredibly clever dialogue.
Yeah.
Thinly veiled threats.
The best dialogue, by the way, is...
yeah, that's pretty good.
I mean, it took a wordsmith rivaling William Shakespeare to come up with that. But yes, do go
you know,
on.
Like the scenes between like Tyrion and Cersei, the scenes with Littlefinger and Roz, the scene with Davos and Salador Saan, like
yeah,
all of those scenes are so well written.
Yeah, yeah.
You come away with a new appreciation of all those characters. I think to me, those kind of scenes define Game of Thrones, especially early on.
Yeah, and for the Tyrion fans, it shows one of his best examples of just flexing on somebody.
Yeah, Janos gets flexed all over.
Just slapped on his ass and sent on his way.
Yeah, which is I'm happy to see because
yeah,
he deserves it.
He's a real shit.
Baby killer. He's I guess, you know, he uses his excuse just following orders, but doesn't hold up for Tyrion.
Yep.
But we'll get there. Are you ready for the recap?
I want to dispense with two points of business. Number one,
okay.
A content advisory. I'm sick, y'all. I'm medicated and well rested, but neti potted. But my body is betraying me, so I apologize for perhaps the shitty quality of my voice. Two, the Lily Stark requested. Where are my dragons? Count still stands at zero. Two episodes
yeah.
in.
It's true.
I'm starting to feel bad. I feel like that this is going to go down as a giant myth busted.
Mm-hmm.
That's like only is said like one or two times and everyone just fucking way blew it out of context. But still stands at zero.
Yeah, after rewatching episode one of Stranger Things and them
uh-huh.
shouting Will every 4 seconds, I've recalibrated my perspective on that.
The Where Are My Blood Riders count
uh-huh.
stands at one
yep.
head.
Mm-hmm.
So the score on that is slightly outpacing the Where Are My Dragons.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood, the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. All right, we start off with Arya meeting Jack and Hagar before the gold cloaks roll up looking for Gendry. When they say they're looking for someone in his party, Yoren threats to cut the guy's leg arteries. The guy says, "We're looking for Gendry specifically, and we'll be back," before riding off. And there's a funny little moment here with Arya having like a secretive girl pee.
She's making her water, as yeah. they say in Game of Thrones.
You think Gendry's like watching from the shadows? That's how he figured it out, or he just kind of knows?
Yeah, I mean, tell. I mean, I get. You know, you can get in trouble assuming someone's gender. Mm-hmm. But I was just thinking, like, when you're seeing, like, you know, Arya and her eyes, and like, she definitely presents as a girl, even with the butch haircut. And yeah, if like slinking out and not like, you know, just pissing like this group of unwashed flea bottom scum probably would, just, you know, against a tree or just in front of people, who knows? Like, I guess it would make you stand out.
Yeah. It's funny too, because Jaqen calls her a lovely boy,
right?
Which I don't know if he's onto her, or if he's just like taking a jab at her, or what. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'll have to. We'll have to see. This guy is an enigmatic guy because he's clearly from the Black Cells, like the rest of these very tough customers. The book informs us is Rorge and Biter. The guy with the filed teeth, I'm assuming, is Biter.
Okay. no, they're ironically named.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. He seems very cool, like a very cool customer that, you know, he's pinned up with these freaks, but they're not really messing with him.
Yeah.
Implying that he could be a real handful. Mm-hmm. I also liked the, you know, speaking of your clever dialogue, like Yoren draws a knife and points at the guy's dick, and you think it's just like the standard, oh, this guy is like doesn't want his dick cut, but then he shows that, like, no, I'm going to bleed you like a pig.
Yeah.
And if here, watch this scene from Black Hawk Down, if you don't know how fast this can all go down. I thought that was really cool, because at first it's like, it's, oh, he's just going to cut his dick, and it's like, oh no, he's going to sever his femoral artery.
And he takes a sword. Like that too.
Night's Watch needs good steel, man.
I bet. They probably need people more than steel,
sure,
is my guess. But,
sure.
They could use both. Raven.
I also like the line that, like, I've just sharpened this knife. I could use it to shave a spider's ass.
If he wanted to.
Like, where do you even come up with that simile?
I don't know. It's a small creature with probably a hairy ass, I guess.
But like, are spiders hair? Like, if you sat down to shave one, are they any worse to cut than others? You know,
I don't know.
Like, if you shave a frog's ass, that'd be impressive because you're shaving something that's not even that you can't even perceive. But a spider's ass, yeah, they're hairy.
Yeah,
they're hairy.
All right, we move on to Tyrion arriving in his room to see Shay chatting with Varys. Varys makes some veiled threats about knowing her background, and he says that Tyrion has no need to worry. He keeps the secrets of his friends safe. On his way out, Tyrion says, "Don't ever threaten me again, or I'll have you thrown into the sea." And Varys is like, "Yeah, well, I'm pretty good at swimming,"
mm-hmm.
basically. There's just a lot of great dialogue in here too. I'm trying to figure out what they're getting at with the fish pie thing. Obviously, it's a sexual innuendo.
Sure.
And Varys, I'm trying to figure out if they think he's gay or asexual.
Well, everyone knows that Varys is a eunuch.
Uh-huh.
So, no, I don't know if Shay... I mean, Shay's picked up on the fact that he's uninterested in her.
Yeah.
But I don't... Yeah, I mean, I guess
he's gay.
My...
I think he's just asexual. Like, yeah. Totally...
Yeah, I think so, too.
Devoid of any sexuality.
Right.
After his incident.
Right. Because, yeah, no, that's my read on him, too. He just doesn't have a sex drive, which is probably a great relief.
He can
probably why he's so damn smart.
Think with his other head, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Sure.
Like, so much of his day is free. He doesn't have to worry about, keeping up with his appearance or trying to get,
although
flirt
he does
with women.
That pretty
or,
well.
That's true.
He's
true.
A little heavy, but other
that's
than that,
not
he's
fair.
Dressed
yeah,
nicely.
He's very, and he's very well dressed.
Clean
and,
cut.
You know, keeping your head shaved. That's not, that requires a daily ritual. So
for sure.
You're right. It's not fair to say he doesn't care about his personal appearance.
Yeah.
More fair to say he just doesn't care about.
I would say the Hound doesn't really care.
Right.
His personal appearance.
Like Salder saying the only god worth worshiping is a woman's vagina. And Varys is like, I'm atheist.
Yeah.
Yeah, just atheist.
It's a great exchange, though, between Varys and Tyrion with the threats.
Yeah.
And I love the way that, like, Tyrion thinks, okay, I've won this moment.
Right.
He takes his hand off the door, and then Varys just puts, like, a finger on the door and gives the speech about the fish and totally, like, flips the tables on him.
Uh-huh.
It's good.
It's good. It's like, good. The whole Ned Stark's a man of honor, I am not.
Uh-huh.
Which is interesting, because that was one of the frustrations of season one, is to see Ned play the Game of Thrones badly,
yeah.
And one of the main pleasures of season two is watching Tyrion play the game competently.
Yeah.
Although it's funny because in this rewatch, I'm a little bit more critical of Tyrion and we'll be talking about that a little bit more in the episode.
Okay,
I feel like he lets some of his flaws get the better of him, and doing the things that he wants to set out and accomplish, which just means he's human.
Sure. And I mean, the biggest flaw of all, I guess, is his affection for whores, which
and wanting to
is
stick
the biggest
it.
Problem in the scene.
But it's like, it's not just that he's got a love of whores. It's almost more like, I'm sticking it to my family. My
sure.
dad's not going to yeah. tell me who the fuck I can and cannot keep company with. It's like, I think if it was just his need to physically gratify himself, he'd be able to mm-hmm. master it.
Yeah.
But we see this in his interaction with the sister. He does have like this need, and it's like he came by it honestly to stick it to his family, as they've stuck it to him so many times. And
right.
it's a major flaw that is fairly easy to exploit, along with, all the attendant things, like the fact that you've given a very dangerous political adversary leverage over you.
Yeah.
Day one, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And then you start playing the game like, well, if Varys so easily found this out, who else knows? This little thing. How many people have this leverage over him? And how long is it going to be until someone whispers it into Cersei's ear?
Mm-hmm. So speaking of Cersei, we go to the throne room, or I guess the meeting of the small council here,
yep.
Meeting room, where Cersei receives Robb's demands, and she tears them up. And Tyrion makes a joke about how great she is at tearing papers, which is awesome. He also says they should give Ned's bones back, and they send off the messenger, but not before Cersei gives him a message for Jaime, which is basically, hey, we didn't forget about you. Then Pycelle gives another raven message to Tyrion, which says Castle Black wants more men to defend against the mounting wildling armies. Oh, and also the dead, which are rising, apparently. Everyone except for Tyrion is completely incredulous, and they don't want to bother sending men.
Yeah.
So the wall gets ignored, basically.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, the only reason Tyrion is on board is because he respects Lord Commander Mormont, and he actually went through the wall.
Yeah.
Like, if you have to think that had he not done that, he would be the ones making the Grumpkins and Snarks jokes along with everybody else.
For sure.
Now, the other question I have with you is that Cersei rips up the paper and says, tell Robb Stark our reply to her cousin, Alton.
Mm-hmm.
Tyrion object previously to that, that said, well, we can at least send Ned Stark's his bone. We can at least send them Ned Stark's bones as a gesture of good faith. Is that the reply we'll send?
I don't think so. I think the reply is fuck you.
Right. Which, that's the thing. Like, I don't... It's a question at this point, like, who has the ultimate power here? Can Tyrion just kind of, like, do in runs around his sister, but if she can find out and put the kibosh on him?
Yeah, I guess it depends on who has Joffrey's ear, ultimately, right?
Right.
Which Tyrion's been slapping him.
Right.
I don't know that that's boding well for Tyrion's chances. So he's probably going to listen to his mom above all other people.
Right.
I imagine this message is going to be fuck you. We don't want any of your demands.
Yeah. It's bad plot. It's bad strategy on Cersei's point. And also, it's Tyrion is sent by his father to bring this boy king and his mother to heal, and he needs to do a better job at it. If this is, because I'm saying, it's like I wasn't sure if his objection, since Cersei didn't say like no fuck that, like if it was supposed to understand that was going to go back, and honestly I don't remember. So
yeah, I don't think so, but I'm not
thought
sure
so
either.
Too. I thought that what they're implying is that Cersei was just sending the giant FU, but I couldn't be sure.
Yeah. Then we move on to Sam and Grin getting an education, we'll say, in what happens when you die.
Yep.
Sam wonders why Craster has so many wives, and Grin tells a story of wrestling a farm girl in his youth. Sam sees Ghost trying to take Gilly's rabbit, and he intervenes, so she calls him very brave, and then he takes her to John and says she's pregnant, so they have to take her with them when they leave. John says no fucking way, and Gilly runs off. And then John lays out just how stupid this plan is. Couldn't agree more with John here. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard Sam say. I feel for her. Like, I don't want her to have to stay there, but there's no way they're going to get her out of there.
Yeah, it is weird because, like, you know, they're like, Sam's already cottoned on this early to the inherent contradiction between the Night's Watch vow, which they defend the realms of men. The fact that these wildlings are indisputably human men and women, and the fact that they can't do anything to help this, like, you know, no one knows exactly what's going on, but everyone knows it's fucked up. And Gilly, you know, the fact that she can't reply to what exactly is going on. Do you think it's going to, like, knowing what you know now, do you think it changes the Lord Commander's mind? Like, if it turns out that Craster is, in fact, sacrificing
eating
his male
babies.
Children to the others, as is implied at the end of this episode, do you think that's going to change the Lord Commander's mind?
I do view him as an honorable person,
right?
Much like Tyrion does. So, yeah, I think possibly it could.
Yeah, so that, me too, because that's the thing. It's like you've got two warring notions in your mind, the fact that... what we know of him as an honorable man, and obviously it's like, okay, what Craster does in his keep, it's his keep, his rules.
Yeah,
but
he's a
on
shit,
the other hand,
but...
there's every man and person has a something that they would consider intolerable, a breaking point.
Right.
You know, like,
Keanu Reeves, you kill his dog, he's coming after you.
Right. and it's different for everybody. But on the other hand, you know, Game of Thrones also in season one showed us that it's kind of a genre. A trope to fire. So, like, it would also be give another couple shades of gray to the Night's Watch, the Black Brothers, to have them just be totally pragmatic and like, well, you know, what are you going to do?
I guess I'd like to hear the argument, you know, from both sides. What is, depending on which decision he makes, how does he justify it? You know, is defending the realms of men defined a certain way in his mind.
Let's say that he could personally attest to that Craster has saved 12 Night's Watchmen from freezing to death or starving when a raid has gone bad north of the Wall.
Right.
Does that excuse however many male children have been sacrificed by him? Like, that's the scale, right? And, like, that's the thing. Like, the real politic works if, like, a reasonable person would look at the situation and be like, okay, well, what do? You let one person die to save a million. But when you're talking about letting, you know, one person be sacrificed to save 12 men who are soldiers, mm-hmm. that starts to, and you're talking about babies and women and children, that starts to be a little stickier. So it's a definite moral quandary they're setting up.
And you're not even just talking about people in that scenario, right? You're talking about the potential, I guess, mission of the Night's Watch, like
right.
about intelligence and like value as, you know, a home base up north and all kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot to weigh. And I think Gior comes down on the side of not tolerating the baby, the gifting of the babies to the others.
We shall see. The other important character development we got here is discovering that Sam's an ass man and Grin's more of a boob guy.
Yeah. Like, well, I don't know.
That's an inference I'm making from which direction they like to see women approach and leave from.
The inference I made is that Sam's never had a woman approach him.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
So he legitimately just doesn't know what a woman looks like walking toward him.
Right. And you can see also Sam's like, please detail. I want to hear more about this lady wrestling. I want to hear more about your adventures in GLOW.
His response is great. How many times? As many times as I could. Which to me implies that maybe it happened just once. It was like a single encounter that lasted as many times as he could.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that play, Grin's not much of a wrestler, if that's the case.
Maybe he wrestled her.
And
I
didn't mean that from like he's bad at raping her. I meant like obviously we're talking about sex here. He's bad at sex, and she's not interested anymore. So
right.
Anyway, who's to say? But it's an important character trait of these guys, regardless.
No, that that farting when you die scene is also really great.
Yeah.
How is Ed such a? I guess he talked about his grandmother, who shit the bed when she died.
That's the thing. Like, if you listen to, like, he's called Dolorous Ed for a reason, because he's always got these, like, Debbie Downer stories he's telling in the background, which are also frequently funny, too.
Right.
Like, he just has the worst life ever.
Okay, we go over to Dani and her caravan, just waiting for the return of the riders. A horse rides up, but it has a rider's head in the saddlebag.
Yeah, what's the opposite of a headless horseman?
The headed horseman.
It's just a horse. Yeah. Just a head horseman. There is,
I guess, the bodiless horseman. Right.
They need to combine into a supergroup,
which is just the horseman.
The formerly headless horseman.
And they're kind of waiting. The horse rides up with a head in the saddlebag. The widow is grief stricken that they didn't burn his body for some religious afterlife reason, I guess.
Kill the soul.
They've got like this Valhalla sort of thing.
He'll never be able to ride to Nightlands with his ancestors.
Yeah. And Dani, I don't think Dani fully understands like the religious significance of all this yet, because she's like, no, they can't kill his soul. Right. She's like, no, they didn't burn his body. His soul's dead. And she's kind of like, oh, yeah, I guess.
I think she understands, because that's what they did with Khal Drogo, and she's wanting to make this funeral pyre. But the thing is, this scene is all about Dani making impotent threats and promises.
Sure.
You know, which is a theme they developed in last episode. Like, she swears vengeance against these, but even, like,
she doesn't even know who it is.
Right. Even Jorah's like, okay, you're going to take these people who are too weak to stand and battle against, you know, Khal, Pono, or Jago, who fucking can't stand the thought of a Khaleesi running a cow.
Uh-huh.
And she also makes this impotent promise that, like, well, we'll make a funeral pyre, and you look around like, with fucking what?
Yeah.
Unless sand can burn, you know, this poor guy is not going to make the Nightland. So I think that's just it sells the frustration that Dani has got where she is with this messianic thing. But, you know, like, if Jesus had just peaked with the turning wine into water, there probably wouldn't be a religion with a billion followers, mm-hmm. right? So she's got to keep following this up and delivering, or it's going to be a flash in the pan.
Yeah. No, it's a good scene. So Theon arrives at the Iron Islands. Before he gets off the boat, he has sex with a not whore because he hasn't paid her.
Yeah.
But I guess his
amateur
concubine, I don't know.
Salt wife.
No, not a salt wife though. He doesn't take her for a salt wife.
No, I mean that's the thing. That's the joke. The salt wives are just like that. Those are men that the Iron Islanders rape and reave. And the rock wives are the ones they actually come home to.
Gotcha.
And she's just, yeah, she's the captain's daughter. For some reason, the captain thinks it's a good idea to bring her. Well, I mean, you know, maybe he's progressive. Maybe he's trying to, he's wanting her to be the first female captain of this shipping company.
It didn't seem like it.
No, it really doesn't.
It seemed like she was more just in the hold.
Really doesn't. But the poor girl got her hopes up. She thought that,
yeah,
you know, she was gonna make it with the king of Iron, the Iron Islands, and, nope. Yeah, I mean, it's a double tragedy because number one, Theon is not going to do that for her. Number two, Theon is king of shit.
Yeah,
as is going to be made abundantly clear. And he's Theon is such an asshole the way he treats this woman, and also how he thinks he's going to be honored and respected. It really shows how out of touch he is with the way of life that he was born to.
Yeah,
like almost. Almost like they didn't do a really good, like, they, it reminded me a lot of, like, what a lot of countries like United States and Australia did with indigenous populations, where they just, like, took their children and just completely indoctrinated them, didn't talk to tell them about the, you know, the quote-unquote old ways. Like, Ned Stark and Master Luwin did a really shitty job of preparing Theon for, you know, well, I mean, I don't think they ever expected him to return, right?
Yeah.
But they really didn't do anything about teaching him what his people were and what they were all about. Because his expectations way away from reality.
Yeah, for sure. I really like the shot they give us of the Iron Islands and of the castle there.
Yeah, it's cool.
I guess is Castle Pike.
Pike is, yeah. Or it's, I think that's the name of the island that it's on, but it's also the castle. Yeah.
It's a really beautiful castle. It's separated onto these kind of three sort of just... mesas? I don't even know what you call them.
Right.
These spires of rock coming out of the ocean.
Right.
With these bridges attaching them. It's beautiful.
And you imagine, like, how hard it would be to to attack that. But yet that's something Ned Stark did. So he brought them to heel after their rebellion. But yeah, it's one of the cooler castles. Although there's not a really a... It's not really of a bummer of a castle.
Shit castle. Yeah. I'd say Winterfell is like the least impressive.
I don't know.
I was unimpressed by the Winterfell castle.
Yeah, Winterfell's got some cool stuff that they don't really talk about in the shows, like the fact it's got a it's heated internally by a geothermal vent, so it stays warm even in winter, and it's got the glass gardens, which provide fresh fruits and vegetables throughout the winter, so it's like it's a sleeper. It's a sleeper castle.
All right, so we go to Littlefinger's brothel, and one of the clients is banging Roz when she starts crying. Littlefinger sends him away with another prostitute and goes to see what's wrong.
Oh, just fucking jizz on the lips.
Yeah, no, it's too much for me. It's,
yeah, the this show sometimes really likes really likes rolling in the gutter.
Yeah, so she's really distraught about Megan's dead baby, and he tells her a story to... At the beginning of it, you think it's to comfort her.
Yeah.
But it turns out that's not who Littlefinger is. He tells her about the story of another whore who cried so much that she wasn't making him any money, so he sold her off into this terrible situation in order to mitigate his losses. Then he gives her the night off.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is...
Chilling.
If you had any notions that Littlefinger was going to be fun to hang around with...
Right.
No.
And that's what makes it other chilling. Like, if he was just a mere bully and just threatened her and went on, it would be one thing. But the way he, you know, there's if you're just going to threaten a woman, just threaten a woman. But to couch it in terms of like, oh, you get her to like, you know, open up to you and be like act like you're, like you said, you're going to comfort her and then be unspeakably horrible.
Yeah.
It's like I said, it's chilling. It really paints Littlefinger out to be this terrible, terrible person. Which
and it's a fantastic scene.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, both of these actors do a great job.
Right.
With this, both the dialogue and just with the pure reaction.
Right.
To what he's saying.
And that's where I've always come down with people like, you know, because a lot of it's easy to compare Littlefinger and Varys, right?
Sure.
But to this point, you know, Varys has not done anything to approaching this kind of like cruelty.
No.
And you know, his business isn't human misery. So it's like I've always come down to like I think Varys is the better guy.
I'm with you. I agree.
We'll keep an eye on these characters as they develop.
Okay. Then we go over to Tyrion having Janos over for a fine feast with fine wine. He brings up the topic of the baby killings and his betrayal of the Last Hand, and Janos gets pissed, starts threatening Tyrion, but Bronn and some gold cloaks have something to say about it. They come in and they take him away to be shipped off to the wall. This is another fantastic scene. I love Tyrion so much.
And that's the thing, like Tyrion, it just shows who Tyrion is, because Tyrion could have had this guy black bagged and just shipped off to the wall, but instead he did it in the style.
He did.
He broke him down, like invited this confrontation, had Bronn back him up, and then in like three or four sentences stripped him of everything.
Yeah.
It's
glorious.
And then the final of the scene where Tyrion troubled says, if I told you to kill a babe at his mother's breast, mm-hmm. would you do it without question? And Bronn's only question is, well, how much is in it for me?
Yeah.
Like, has he made he's even questioning himself, like, Jesus, what is my ally? Is this city watch? I mean, mm-hmm. this watch commander is superior only in as much as he's, for now, loyal to me.
Right.
And what could I offer him that my sister couldn't?
Sure.
It
should probably worry him.
Yeah.
And it does. You can see it on his face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, he wishes he had a Ned Stark that he could make city commander, because you had the same effect, except for that now, I don't know. Would Tyrion want a Ned Stark like because he might think, well, this guy's going to think too much for himself.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'd be worried about with a Ned.
You want a lackey, but you want a mm-hmm. lackey that's loyal to you for purely personal reasons.
Yeah.
Like you got a life debt to you or something. This money thing is just too, it's another meditation on where power lies, right?
It is. Then we go over to Hot Pie trying to explain that a bar fight is basically a battle when the knights are wearing armor. And Gendry drops a knowledge bomb on him about anyone being able to buy armor.
Well, how do you know? Because I sold armor. Right. So good.
He just walks off, because what do you say to that? Arya starts quizzing him about why he's being looked for, and he explains that the Hand of the King came looking for him, asking about his mom, but he doesn't really know why. And he asks her about her past and why she's hiding the fact that she's a girl, and she decides to reveal her true identity and where she's headed. So I guess she better hope Gendry doesn't get caught.
Yeah.
At this point.
And then he mercilessly teases her about it, too, the whole My Lady stuff.
No, it's good.
It is good. We get some feedback about their relationship. Do you see, because I guess I don't, maybe I don't see it, but do you see any romance potential between the two?
No, I see it more of like a brother-sister.
That's what I'm
seeing
too. Big brother.
Like older brother, younger sister, yeah.
Yep. I don't know if that could change, but that's how I read this situation. I didn't see it as flirty so much as just teasing their little sister.
Right. Okay. Anything else about that scene?
Nope.
Should we move on? Okay, Theon goes ashore, and he pays an old man some money for a horse to get him to Pike. Then a woman approaches him and says, I can take you there. He immediately hits on her, and during the ride, he feels her up. They get to the castle, and Theon approaches his father, who is unimpressed by his fancy clothes. And when Theon reveals the message from Robb and the plan to defeat his enemies, he's equally unimpressed. And the woman he rode in with is revealed to be his sister, Yara, who is apparently a better heir to the Iron Islands than Theon ever could be, according to Baelon. Baelon decides to burn the message.
Man,
not a very warm reception here.
Cersei's a burner, or Cersei's a ripper, he's a burner.
Yeah, that shouldn't have been his line. You've mastered the art of burning messages, father.
Man, this is super gross, because
it's awesome. Like, this is a great reveal. Yes, it's disgusting.
Right. But he's had his hands down his sister's pants, doing some stuff, paddling her man in the canoe. And
line about the grandchildren, like,
And she's doing it just to make her busting his balls later more glorious, which tells you a lot. It tells us a lot about Theon, a lot about her, and a lot about the family itself.
Sure.
And this whole lecture. Like, I'm also really impressed at how well they sell the Iron Islanders' lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Like, you heard Catelyn Stark, like, Balon Greyjoy can't be trusted because he's untrustworthy because he can't be trusted. With, this whole, they hit you with the salt wife versus rock wife. Then now you got the iron price or the gold price. And how just Balon works every one of Theon's insecurities mm-hmm. and strips him of his masculinity, which is interesting. and then puts his, you know, then after he does that, like, he makes it out to, like, a woman's the worst fucking thing you can be. Mm-hmm. You're dressed like a whore and dressed wearing a little dress. Then his sister is going to be commanding in the fleet. It's really a...
Yeah, it sells the things that they value. Right?
Yeah, and why he is insulted by this offer for Rob to, like, well, if you help me with my, I'll let you be king. And he's like, fuck that. I'm going to pay the iron price for it. And yeah. Then, chillingly, when Theon says, you don't stand a chance against the Lannisters, he says, who said anything about the Lannisters?
Uh-huh.
Which, gulp.
Where's he going?
I mean, we know that they took great pains to explain that the Robb's raised all of his banners and has kind of made the land bereft of men, and those armies are south. This is where, you know, it's not that Rob's dumb, it's just his inexperience. The fact that this offer and that he trusted Theon to make is also a signal of weakness.
Sure.
Like, I need your help, and I'm off doing something else, so Rob doesn't see the implicit, like, the precarious situation he's put his realm in.
Yeah, especially after the I'll call it a relationship. It is a relationship that they have, the Starks and the Greyjoys, right?
Right.
It's not exactly a friendly one. And that's the thing. Like, they do a great job of showing just how out of touch Theon is, not only because, you know, he comes back and he doesn't quite understand, like, oh, his clothes are not going to be accepted here.
Right.
But there's so much in it that he doesn't get about their culture, even though... You can tell he's well read on the subject, right? But he's never experienced it.
Yeah, like the fact that, like, a commoner like the Iron Islander Sam Elliott is just going to openly scorn him, and not do anything that he doesn't pay for. Like, that's just a it is a shock. I said they did a bad job of preparing him for what being a Greyjoy was actually like, and also
the idea that he understands the customs intellectually, but not like in his bones, in his blood, as he would
say.
And
the fact that Rob's made the same mistake because he sees Theon as this, you know, like this half brother of his, and he would think that the Iron Islanders would be open to this kind of offer.
Yeah.
So bad political strategy all around.
Sure is. Then we go to Davos, trying to convince his pirate friend Salladhor Saan to back them in the war. Then he says he'll help if he can have the queen for himself. Davos Saan can't believe what he's hearing, so Salladhor threatens to fuck him, essentially. Sorta. That exchange is one of my favorite ones in this entire episode.
Salladhor Saan is a great, great fucking character.
Yeah.
I want to see a lot more of him.
He finally does agree to help Davos, and afterward Davos' son pleads with him to believe in the gods and learn to read, so I guess he can believe in the gods by reading their books. Davos doesn't give a shit about gods or religion. He's just following Stannis at this point.
Yeah. Stannis is his god. Now, they also dropped this information about, you know, this Salladhor Saan says, you know, about how loyal he is to, or how loyal Davos is to Stannis. He goes, man, the man chops off your fingers and you fall in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
Last episode, Stannis made some offhand comment to Davos about how, you know, how his deep commitment to justice and stuff. And he's like, as you well know, we're starting to see, it's like, you know, what exactly is the deal with this guy's hand? They're building this up pretty slowly for us to be curious about the backstory between, like, what the hell happened between this former smuggler and pirate and this now king that this intensely loyal situation has developed.
Yeah, and I don't quite know the situation there. I think even having seen 7 seasons of this show, I still don't quite know the situation.
Well, good.
I must have missed it somewhere along the way.
Good, because it makes the conceit of this podcast, as if we haven't seen the show, that much more believable.
Right. So what do you think 30 ships is going to do for Stannis's army?
At
that point, it's not an army, it's a navy.
Because I was thinking that, too, in light of what we heard about Theon Greyjoy's, or I'm sorry, Balon Greyjoy's 200 ships, and in light of, like, the, let's say, numbers that we've seen throughout Game of Thrones history.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what they're trying to say, this is selling the desperation of Stannis, because he's willing to stoop to something that he obviously finds personally distasteful to get a mere 30 ships.
Yeah.
Which is... they've already told us is not a significant navy by Westerosi standards.
Yeah.
If he wasn't so desperate, and you know, the next scene is all about like how desperate his military situation is. So I think it's just to sell us on, like I said, that's the great thing about the show is like there's multiple ways to tell us about the situation, which makes it more colorful.
Yeah. Okay. Cersei is pissed about Tyrion sending Janice away, and Tyrion brings up the baby murder. And Cersei's acting a little bit strange, so he figures out that Joffrey's actually the one who gave the order. And Cersei sort of laments that, oh, I'm the only one taking the rule of the kingdom seriously.
Right.
And, yeah. And then they have this exchange about, you know, Tyrion killing his mother on the way out. And, like, all of that is just, you know, the cruelest joke to Cersei.
And that's the thing. Like, I think Tyrion had a chance when he deduced that Joffrey was behind it, and Cersei's privately worried about all this stuff too,
yeah,
which she also revealed in the previous episode, maybe some chance to make a headway, but he couldn't help himself but tweak her about her relationship Jamie, with Jaime.
Yeah.
And then she just hardens herself against him. And the thing is like, yeah, that hurts Cersei, but it devastates Tyrion.
Yeah.
This is this open wound that he's asking her to poke, and that's, you know, the major flaw of Tyrion. Like, he could have made real headway here in progress, and, you know, like, I don't know that Cersei ever would have come fully onto his side, but, you know, anything you can do to mute her antagonism would be a bit of, and he just can't do it. Cannot do it.
Yeah.
It's one thing to treat Janice Slynt like that. Another thing, your sister, who is queen regent and is got the ear, if anyone has the ear of Joffrey, she does. And he squanders it. I mean, that's a damn shame.
I think the one thing that I wish they would have done differently in this scene is maybe show that Tyrion has been hit and jabbed in this way many, many, many times.
Right.
Because he essentially, like, has a negative reaction to it and is like, grumble, grumble, grumble when she brings up the joke thing.
I thought he looked really shattered.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my point. Like, he's been hit with this over and over and over in his lifetime, right? Like, us as audience members are just hearing this for the first time.
Right.
But you have to imagine that she has told him, this is the cruelest joke,
sure,
and you're the cause of our mother's death over and over again.
And it still affects
him. So at this
him.
Point, right, I don't think it should affect him, I guess, as much as it does on screen. I think he should essentially, you know, go this old shit again.
Yeah, it's weird, like, what kind of emotional armor he has versus where his weak points are. And, like, you know, he doesn't have the benefit of, like, talk therapy to, like, come up with useful skills to handle that. So it's like, I don't know. It's like, I mean, obviously people get inured to both physical and emotional pain. Like, that's like, you know, you skin your knee when you're a three-year-old and you cry, and then you barely even notice as you get older in life. But sometimes, I don't know, like, I felt believable that he'd still has this, you know, since everyone that he's cared about and been close to has been reminded him of his station, and he's a dwarf and he's killed his mother. Like, maybe he's just defenseless against that. And again, that's another part of the flaw, that, like, you go kick Cersei in the ass and you have no plan to deal with her claws and teeth.
Yeah, that seemed weird to me.
Right.
Because, like, they've had to have had arguments like this before.
Right.
Where each of them are taking their jabs, and does it always end in Tyrion essentially losing?
Yeah, I mean,
because of that one notion that she killed their mother.
I think maybe the other thing is, like, how many arguments have they had in private?
Yeah,
like, since they both, because they, you know, Cersei was married off young to Robert, and they've always, like, they would never have this argument in front of their father.
Sure.
So, like, maybe it is not the case that he's heard this shit dozens of times, like, you know, especially as an adult, or maybe it's been 10, 15 years since she come back and he thought he had her at a moral disadvantage, and wow, she hits him with this.
Yeah.
It just does show that he's a little, like, he's not, this isn't the triumph that maybe we want it to be, that he is a little off balance and not on firm footing here in King's Landing.
Yeah, definitely. So Davos reports his recruiting success to Stannis, and Stannis dismisses them, but not before Melisandre can sort of get her hooks into Davos' son by saying a death by fire is the purest death. And then Stannis is kind of questioning her religious shit, put up against the pure numbers of the situation. She says he has to give all of himself, and then implores him to fuck her by saying, I'll give you a son. And he does.
Yeah.
That's his weakness, the son, the heir.
And you could see, like, how much of a fight did Stannis put forth here?
Because not that
she's, yeah, it's like, yeah, she had to answer for all of his, I've got a wife, and she's a shit wife. I've taken vows. They were shit vows. And look at me, these breasts are fantastic.
He should have said, those are shit breasts.
And she's like, you lie, you know it.
Yeah, he's clearly lying.
But... Right. I tell you what, I didn't notice this the first time, you know, through, but like the imagery of them fucking on that painted table of Westeros as all the pieces that represent men and armies fall to the ground is so evocative that, you know, it tells us that, you know, regardless what you think about the morals, like these actions are going to make the realm bleed.
Mm-hmm.
Like this war of the five kings that they're or I think that Cersei hints at, she's like, what are we up to now? Five kings? I thought that was just great imagery.
Yeah. No, it is for sure. I had a hard time seeing it because of Stannis' like floppy peasant boots. Yeah, like he's got leather sacks on his feet.
You,
man,
you need to get something that was non slip grip footing if you're going to be right. doing that kind of work in a damp environment, Stannis.
Yeah, on a table that's slightly too high for you.
Right. Yeah. You can't just quite get the He's going to make it work though. He's going to make it work.
He did apparently. Yeah.
He's due. If nothing else, Stannis is dutiful.
All right, we go up to Craster's keep, and John sees Craster taking a baby into the woods, and he follows him until Craster drops the baby. And just as John's about to see where, or I guess who's taking the male babies and where they go, he's knocked out by Craster, and the episode ends.
Right, hits him with the blackjack. Bam.
Yeah, so you seem to think that this is the others. I had a hard time like getting a good view
I was debating as I was watching the scene. I'm like, oh, can I actually say this is the others? And then you saw the piercing blue eyes.
Did you?
Oh yeah. It's not for very long, but you can see the two like Jawa eyes, only they're neon blue.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's another. They've established that as their defining feature.
Yeah.
So I feel comfortable saying that it's not a spoiler that he's offering up his sons to the White Walkers. Now, to what end and why and all those are questions that obviously the show wants us to ask and be desperate for the knowledge of, because it's a good cliffhanger.
I'm desperate.
If nothing else, we know Craster's not going to be happy with John sneaking up and spying on him. And
it's over, man. I mean, this whole situation is not good. I mean, John has already challenged Craster once.
And that's the thing, like go ahead. I'm sorry.
This second time of like sneaking around and following him, he's not going to tolerate.
And like
this.
The debate we were having about what Gior will do is complicated, because now it's not going to be like John and Sam are going to present him with a decision that he can weigh on. It's going to be an angry Craster with John's life in the balance, and what the hell is going to, you know, like there's like what it's really putting him in an uncomfortable position.
Assuming John's not dead already.
Right.
Craster might have murdered him.
Right. I'm comfortable spoiling that piece of information. If you've seen an Entertainment Weekly in the last 5-6 years, you know he's going to stick around for a little longer. But to your point, any concussive injury to your head
could just
bad news
be the end. Yeah.
Like John, he survives, but he's just a vegetable for the rest of the season,
which
doesn't diminish his pretty.
Well, we didn't hear him fart,
Entertainment Weekly. We know
that he's not dead.
That's right. It would have been
that's conclusive.
Hilarious if it faded to black, the music, and you just hear the. You know, missed opportunity. Maybe we can do. Maybe we can do it as a YouTube clip.
There you go. good stuff. And that's the end of the episode.
Sure,
I thought it was
is.
A really, really good one.
Before we get into feedback, I like to pitch the club, because it's how we pay the bills around here. And there's a special feature for non-club members. At the end of this podcast, we're going to have a small snippet of our segment we call Quit Your Pitchin', which is something we do every month. The first Wednesday, we release a podcast where we just pretend to pitch shows. We have this random show title generator, and we come up with something that we think would be based on what that show would be like in reality. We try to cast it, and sometimes they're poignant, sometimes they're funny. Mm-hmm. This week, Passport the Hulk, where we come up with an idea that the Hulk has been banned from America because he keeps tearing shit up when he gets angry, and his travels around the world and what that would look like. So you can stay to the end of the podcast and enjoy that. Or you can sign up for the club at club.baldmove.com, where for a low price, you can get access to all the bonus content, as well as video versions of our podcast, exclusive VIP access to our forums, and a bunch of other stuff. You can get the pitch there. You can try it out for 30 days risk-free by signing up at club.baldmove.com. We appreciate your support. Real quick, before we get into the meat of the episode, I want to do some housekeeping. First, there's only just over a week left in the Game of Thrones pod pack charity thing that we did, where we got a bunch of leading Game of Thrones podcasters, including ourselves, and we did a bunch
That's very haughty of us.
But true.
True. Oh, Jesus. All right, yeah. That's less haughty.
I'm saying we're among. I didn't say we're the leaders, although we are. I'm just saying we're amongst that august company. And,
we are,
you know, we got together. We did a bunch of one-off episodes about different aspects of the Game of Thrones experience and universe. Like ours was on the religion of religions in Westeros and the doom of Valyria. Mm-hmm. You can go check it out. Podpack.baldmove.com. It goes to charity. We're donating the proceeds, so splitting it between the podcasters and the ACLU, and also Jim and I have giving our entire cut to the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund. And there's, we might have to split that up too, because the
hurricanes to choose from.
The hurricanes keep on coming.
I think we had one here this morning.
It's like the War of the Five Hurricanes coming.
Yeah,
and the realm is bleeding, and
Hurricane Stannis.
It needs help. So you can check that out for another week. Also, we did a review for Mother, the new Aronofsky film, and we're doing a review of Kingsman 2 opening night, actually on Thursday night. As well, both of those, you have the free non-spoiler review of it, and then we also have a spoiler-filled review for club members. Continuing coverage of Game of Thrones, Cecily and I are still doing American Horror Story Cult season. Last week we released a quip for club members. You can get a preview of that at the end of this podcast if you want. And this week we're doing a playthrough of the chapter 2 of A Wolf Among Us, the Telltale video game, where if you're not familiar with that, we essentially play the worst version of the character we can. Like, we make all the asshole choices, and if you played it if you play any of these games as a good guy, which most people do, we try to get as little, like, at the end they tell you, like, all the decisions you made versus what other players did. We try to go for as small a percentage of choices as we can.
Mm-hmm.
All the bad choices. So that's what's coming up this week on baldmove.com.
Do we have some feedback to do?
Oh, we do.
That's probably spoilery though, right?
You can send. Well, we have a few non-spoiler emails to consider,
okay.
And we have a few spoiler emails to consider. Those will be at the very end of the episode if you want to avoid all that. GameofThrones@baldmove.com is your source to send this stuff into, or you can also go to forums.baldmove.com to discuss it with your fellow fans. First up, Doug C., along with many, many others, sent in a correction. Just wanted to write in to smugly and arrogantly correct a mistake you made on your Episode 2, Season 1 cast regarding the Citadel Raven.
There's no mistakes.
The White Raven was to mark the change of season from summer to fall rather than fall to winter.
What?
Dude, I was as shocked as anyone because I thought in my bones that that was to announce winter, but I actually went on to, like, not just because, like, the Game of Thrones wiki, which is for the show, I consider a lesser source than the A Song of Ice and Fire wiki. Because, mm-hmm. like, they, you know, the Double D's can do whatever the fuck they want, but the Song of Ice and Fire's got the capital T truth. And apparently any change of season. Like,
really?
How stupid is it to send a fucking White Raven to announce spring?
Yeah.
And
that
summer.
That doesn't make sense.
I mean, like, dye 'em. Like, there's one someone suggested. It'd been cool if they sent an orange one for fall and a white one for winter, but, like. And also, in a world where summers can last for 10 fucking years, I don't know. Like, what, like, does that literally mean they've been growing crops for 10 fucking years and now's the time to harvest? Or is like I said, I'm bitching and moaning because I'm wrong. But I was wrong, and everybody, and Doug C., the smug and arrogant one, is the first one to correct it. So I gave the credit to him. But,
okay.
Yeah, mea culpa. That was an honest surprise. Geoff H., regarding your discussion of power is power, Littlefinger proves that power is in fact not power in this interaction with Cersei. She needs him. He knows it. Sure, she could have had him killed, but if you're unwilling to use your power, it really isn't power, is it?
But if Littlefinger's unwilling to use his information, it's not
power
either.
Well, that's the thing.
Like,
yes, I mean, I guess it's one of those things where it's like a rock, paper, scissors thing. If Cersei kills Littlefinger, yes, she proves her power in the moment, but what does that do to the court? What message does that send to Varys? What message does that send to the other people who have aspects of the truth if you just go around trying to silence it willy-nilly? Mm-hmm. Like, in the long run, knowledge is probably power. In the short run, power is definitely power. But, like, it's one of those things where if you use power unwisely, it doesn't necessarily fresh. You can expend power, and that actually costs you long term. So, I mean, that's the tension in the show. Like,
yeah,
in that moment, when you got a knife to your throat, it doesn't matter how much you know. Power, that raw power is power. But if like, you know, killing Ned obviously lost her half the kingdom. I mean, I know this North is not half the kingdom population, but by just landmass it is. Like, so, like, yes, that was an act of power by Joffrey, but at what cost?
And yeah,
that make him more or less powerful in the long term.
Sure.
Whereas
if
he had the fucking knowledge of politics and history and all that stuff, he might he might have sent Ned to the Black and, you know, kept the. I mean, yeah, there's so many things that went down in season one that if you had a competent leadership, speaking both to both Robert and Joffrey, the realm would have been better. But that's kind of the point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the reason so many things were going against Robert is because he's a weak king. And now he's got a weak idiot cruel king. We got a weak idiot cruel king. So
yeah, that's why I like looking at that scene through the lens of the bird, the Varys little bird.
Yeah,
because he seems to be playing it much smarter.
All right, we got a couple more. I thought we had more, but I actually had to make as I was reading. I'm like, they're minor spoilers because if I talk like you know, it's like if I compare and contrast people with later performances, even though it's not really a big spoiler, it tells people that, like, yeah, I'm fine. It's fine. Kit Harington, he's a survivor. Jon Snow's got an arc, but it really starts to blur the lines. And I think last season we erred on the side of not caring so much about that, and we got negative feedback. So this season I'm erring on the side of maybe perhaps overly caring about it.
Okay.
Because there is, after all, a spoiler section that you're about to get to
in
a minute or two that we can consider all that, so...
How do they get to that spoiler section?
You just stay online. Just keep listening. The music will come up here. Right?
I don't really have an outro for this show.
You don't?
For the theme song? No.
You don't?
So I don't usually put music.
Oh, you don't? I thought you did.
No,
have
we
music.
Do. We do an outro, and then I do a little silence, and then we
okay,
go into the
whatever,
spoilers.
Man.
But
you're the producer.
Because I just don't have an outro for this.
I'm just a talent. I don't. I do what I do. I'm half the time surprised when I hear the podcast. Like, what the hell? Jim did that? Okay.
All right. Well, there's not going to be any music, but there will be an outro. We'll sign off, and then we'll go into the spoilers.
And that's happening right now. So if you want to follow everything we're doing here at Bald Move, you can go to baldmove.com or follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @or/BaldMove as the social media platform likes it. You know how this all works. Everyone knows how this works. Like, if you're a 76-year-old grandmother and you listen to a podcast, you know how social media works.
Mm-hmm.
Just Bald Move.
You're probably Instagramming, like, doilies.
Instagramming.
Oh, Jesus.
Doilies. With that, we'll be back next week with another episode. And all you spoiler people, come on with us over the gap of silence.
Yeah. See you then.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa. starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back with the spoilers. What do you got?
The first thing that tickled me, this is one of my oldest and favorite of the tinfoil theories, but there's this theory about Varys being, in fact, a mermaid or a merman.
I've heard vague mentions of this.
A Merlin, as they call it in the Game of Thrones universe. And if you want to know more, I will put a link to the spoiler archive. There's an archive about the Varys theories. And this scene... is one of the linchpin parts of the theories that like they established the plausibility of being mermaid, and then when he replies to Tyrion,
paddling.
Yeah, and he goes, "Hey, I'm gonna throw you into the sea. Well, you might be surprised at the result."
Oh my god!
Hey, I'm not saying Varys is a mermaid. I'm just saying it's a fun theory.
Scraping the bottle
and
of the bottom
of
that theory.
You haven't even considered the evidence.
With that piece of evidence, I think they're scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Well, there's a whole 15-minute spoiler section I did several years ago. And if you follow the link to the archive, you can find that. And there's a ton of them. Like, turns out Roose Bolton might be a vampire. Lots of other fun ones. And some serious ones, too. I also thought it was really fun to watch Bronn continue to climb this ladder of chaos. Like, he's right behind Peter. He's got his hands right behind the rungs. Like, he went from being a mere sellsword to getting paid big fat coin by Tyrion to now he's City Watch.
Yeah.
Which...
the commander of the Gold Cloaks, is that right?
And then you think about, like, yeah, he's got to do what Tyrion does, but also the opportunities for graft and corruption that are now open to Bronn as the commander of the city's police force.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, is that the guy you really want to have running it?
Yeah.
That's going to go up tenfold.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen The Godfather. I've seen Training Day. I've seen American Gangster. I know how this shit works. It's going to be harder to find an honest gold cloak than it is to find the virgin and Littlefinger's brothels by the end of this episode.
Yep.
All right. Do you have any? Because that's really, there wasn't a whole lot of. I mean, the other thing is like, what else is there? Because most of the plots that they introduce here are going to come to fruition. Like, you know, the thing with Craster and the others. And there's not a whole lot of like really, really deep. Other than, I guess, and there's also some feedback. So I didn't have a lot of other points. Did you?
No, I enjoyed like the sort of contentious relationship that Varys and Tyrion have upon, I guess, really first meeting here.
Is it contentious? Or I think that...
A little bit. I think they're feeling each other out to try and see, like, how much do I have to worry about this person with based on my goals? Especially, like, I really just enjoyed it in light of the roadshow that they have later on.
Yeah.
You know, and how that relationship kind of blossoms.
Yeah.
It's good.
I mean, I see your point, like, because I was thinking, like, Tyrion called it a threat, and it it certainly is the threat of a threat. But I felt like the
finesse, if you're not my friend, I'm threatening you. If you are,
then we got nothing to worry about. Yeah. We're cool. And like these are my like you've displayed your qualities. Now allow me to display my own. Mm-hmm. And he did it in like so classy too that like I feel that. I feel like Varys did a great job of putting his best foot forward here because he did establish himself as a friend and also he's got a steel fist with a velvet glove over it as well. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, if he went to war against Tyrion, that's the thing. Like Tyrion doesn't have a lot of friends at court. Like he's got the power because Tywin's standing behind him. But you know, if he pisses off too many people and he mm-hmm. becomes as big of a problem as what Tywin's wanting to head off with Cersei, and so it's really interesting.
He's got to think about what happens when Tywin gets back,
right?
Because he's only acting hand; he's right. not actually the hand,
right?
And when Tywin comes back, Tywin's going to take that over, yeah. and he can't just piss everybody off here and say and hide behind this pin.
Yeah, and that's another like this is the developing tragedy that like you know Tyrion's going to do a really good job and arguably save the realm.
Yeah.
And or save King's Landing in time for Tywin to come and I guess say, but then he's going to have all that stuff stripped. That's greatest high, and then Tyrion goes into his lowest lows right afterwards. Mm-hmm. And all that I said about Tyrion and his weaknesses you can apply to all the Lannisters, because you know Tywin could have come and given him an attaboy and then had you know a loyal subservient son for the end of time, but he fucking can't bring himself to do it.
Yeah.
Largely because of the same thing Cersei's got, you know, like right. Everything that Cersei said are things that Tywin thinks and Tyrion knows it. Mm-hmm. So it's great for family drama. Should we get on to the listeners' points?
Yeah.
All right. Christy's up first. And this is one I bumped from non-spoiler to spoiler because what struck me last weekend was when I started rewatching season two is how much more expressive Tyrion's face is without the beard. Don't want to spoil the fact that he has a beard and that he survives this season is the unfortunate thing. He's still enjoyable to watch, though his hijinks and snark have been dialed down. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, that character changes drastically. It's not just that, you know, he got a beard and you can't see him making the snark as well. He doesn't quite have the snark in him.
The snark has died out in the
world. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's not the guy who's whistling through the halls anymore, right?
Whistling the reins of Castamere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's the guy who's scarred both physically, emotionally.
Right, he's drinking and he drinks too much. And
right, he is a shadow of himself by season six.
Yeah, so it's interesting because you could. I wonder what you'd say, Christy, if he had been clean shaven.
Mm, yeah.
Because I think they did that to sell the physical transformation in the books. Tyrion loses his nose and has mm-hmm. a just hideously scarred from his battle at the Blackwater and becomes even more the monster that people make him out to be physically, grotesque.
Yeah.
And in the show, they give him a dark beard because they want to sell that physical transformation without mm-hmm. making him ugly, because you can't be in a Hollywood production and be ugly.
But they fuck up the Hound. I don't know why, like, they'll go to because those links for the Hound.
That's the character. Like, I don't... that's a good question, because that also is soft evidence that maybe Tyrion is going to have a romantic interest, whereas the Hound is just like that's his story. Like, he is Quasimodo. like, he's never going to get the girl. You're going to find out he's virtuous and heroic, but he's, you know, he's more of a tragic figure, whereas preserving... Plus, the other thing is, Peter Dinklage could just be like, I'm not sitting in the fucking makeup chair. I'm not wearing green paint on my nose just because you want me to have a hole in my face.
That's the thing. You can stick the Hound. You can stick that guy in a chair and make him up like the Hound with the prosthetic.
Right, right.
Whereas you have to do digital inserts for Tyrion every second he's on the scene, and he's a much more major character.
Right.
It's
hard to say, though. I think it's more that he's a higher paid, higher profile, and I don't know if it all comes down to that. So. But, you know, that's the thing. My first thing is like, well, maybe they still want to be handsome because they have to sell some kind of, like, maybe he gets with Sansa at the end or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
She continues, also, Melisandre is more of a fake generic person accent this season. I believe the actress is non-native English speaking. You're right. She's Dutch, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
Von Houten. Maybe that is a real accent and has evolved away over the years. If not, if I'm ignorant on that front, school me. Do you think her speaking is appreciably different? I got to say, I didn't notice.
Neither did I.
I feel like she's always had this quasi-exotic accent. and maybe it's not as noticeable as Shay, but it is. And then, I mean, it would make, I don't want to say you're wrong, Christy, because it would make sense that she, as she continues to do English speaking roles, that she would maybe try to mute the accent a little bit more, because, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in sounding American in the world,
or even just defining the character's accent over the years, you know, honing in on what makes the character,
right?
That might be part of it,
right? Because I mean, that's kind of that her character is also, like, you know, one part of the thing we think we know about her is she was sold into slavery and she's very lowborn, but now she's amongst high society and she's perhaps playing with that a little bit more of a cultured accent to appeal to that. But it's tough, and to be honest, I don't notice a big difference. Robert H. How is Cersei going to play the marriage? This is on current business. How is Cersei going to play in a marriage alliance with Euron Greyjoy when she is openly telling everyone she's pregnant with Jaime's baby? Euron knows his Kraken has not breached her loins and doesn't seem the type to take that sort of slight lightly. With Jaime leaving King's Landing, my theory is that Cersei will try the old switcheroo with Euron and him not buying it. I'm thinking that she will end up in the Valley of Flowers role from Winds of Winter sample chapter, namely being naked, pregnant, with her tongue cut out, tied to the prow of his ship. Yeah, I this is my standard response to any Greyjoy cruelty. It's like, I don't know that I need more torture porn in my... No, I know I don't need more torture porn in my Game of Thrones. Whether we get it or not is another matter.
Sure.
The other thing is, like, you're saying that you know that Euron's not breached her with his Kraken, which, ew, but I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Yeah, we don't know that. How
it
do you
could
know that?
Be that she's taken him to bed, and then she also took Jaime to bed, which was kind of an abrupt character shift for her, just to, I mean, Cersei is a very manipulative character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's like the really terrible stereotype of a woman, like using her womanly powers in these conniving ways. But, like, I wouldn't, and because of that, I wouldn't put it past her to be, you know, trying to hedge her bets.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in the books, that's, like, you know, what eventually catches her up with Jaime, the fact that Jaime finds out that she has been using what's between her legs, the curry favor in King's Landing, all over the place, multiple times, and it kind of turns him off of it. So I think there's a potential that he finds that out about Euron, which is one of the things that cements his, you know, separation from his sister. But
I'm pretty sure we talked at some length about that in season 7 podcast.
It's honestly hard for me to tell because, like, it's clear to me that a lot of people sending in feedback do not listen to the feedback section. So I try to, like, okay, how many episodes has it been since we discussed this topic? Also the fact that, like, the audience kept getting larger as the, you know, so it's like I don't expect people to have to go back and listen to every fucking podcast we do. So apologies if this is a well-worn topic, but I think you're right with your analysis. I just don't know if you have all the right information. Christopher W. So I've been listening to Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire on Audible because I didn't want to take the time to read the thousands of pages. In doing so, I've come around. Also, thank you for supporting one of our sponsors.
Yeah.
In doing so, I've come around to like what the Double D's did with the Sansa and Arya reunion and even Jon and Sansa's season 7 relationship. Sansa's reunions with Jon and Arya are actually very true to everyone's character when compared to how they were when we last saw each other. In book one, Sansa is continuously a spoiled brat that treats both Jon and Arya like trash. There are times when Arya calls Jon their brother, and Sansa wastes what little time she has pointing out that he's only their half-brother. While Arya and Robb treat Jon warmly, Sansa tends towards Catelyn's treatment of the bastard and looks down upon him and acts and speaks to him as a lower-class individual. As far as Arya, Sansa was absolutely horrible to her. Why would Arya just run and jump into her arms upon meeting them again when the last Sansa knew... she was continuously deriding her. After one of Arya's dancing lessons with Cyril left Arya bruised, Sansa smirked, "You must be a horrible dancer." Not to mention telling Arya that she wished she was dead. Furthermore, right after the Lannisters took Ned hostage and killed all the Stark's men, Sansa asked about the well-being of several people, I believe even Jean Poole's dad, but never thought to ask about Arya's whereabouts or well-being. Continues to make the point that the people expecting the big, heartfelt, joyous reunion between the Starks and the Half-Starks was not as realistic as, like, what they actually presented, which is Jon and Arya being wary of Sansa based on their interactions. Do you think that's fair?
I don't think that's shown nearly as much in the show.
Yeah.
I do think Sansa is concerned with other things.
Uh-huh.
But and she's a shit toward Arya, I think. Both of them are shits toward each other.
Yeah.
But it's not really shown so much with Jon. I'd say, like, if anybody in that situation hated Jon, it was Catelyn.
Yeah.
Above all. I didn't feel much animosity from Sansa toward Jon.
I mean, I definitely think it was there in the show, and certainly between her and Arya. And
but
I guess
not to that degree. Like,
the other thing is, I guess that, I mean, I've seen it in real life where people let shit patterns that developed when they were kids influence how they see each other as adults.
Sure.
And like, when, you know, and again, it's a mistake, it's a tragedy, but it's a very believable one, that when, you know, you're presented with the ability to see your brother or sister in a favorable or poor light, you fall back on the patterns you know.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone sees, like, you can see how much you've changed, but it's harder to see how much other people have changed. So, and the other thing is, yeah, years have passed, but these people are still, like, what many people would call kids, right?
Like, Sansa, yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, Sansa, like, in real life, is Sophie Turner even 20 yet?
Probably about, yeah, almost.
Like, late teens, early 20s, are still, like, the, you know, they're fully formed as far as their intellectual capacities, their physical capacities, but they just haven't had the experience that comes, that gives you true wisdom, or at least it's much harder for them to acquire that.
Yeah.
So I never felt like it was unrealistic. I understand why people, because it would have been, I guess it's the more Hollywood thing for them to all be like, all is forgiven, and oh yeah, we love you so much, and it's all trust and love party, but I don't know.
But I think the peace they have come to has been earned.
Yeah.
I think season 7, if anything, did a pretty good job of bringing them back together in a satisfying way. I mean, say what you want about how realistic you think it is based on a relationship they may or may not have on screen. But I didn't ever feel like this is completely out of character for them.
Yeah.
Like that scene in the crypts between Sansa and Arya
right.
went sort of exactly how you expect it to, right?
Right.
They have a relationship and they're familiar with each other, but they kind of have to see where each other stand before they're willing to, so I guess, like, get into any kind of pattern.
It's also interesting that they sent this on in attached to this episode, because you see essentially the same thing that went on between Balon and Theon, where Arya's like, you've been spending all of your time with our enemies and you've married half of them.
Yeah.
And I don't trust you. And Sansa's like, you've been God knows where with this weird death cult. I don't trust you. And Jon, you know, I think there's lots, like I said, it seems like there's lots of earned tension. So I totally agree.
And the Fully reunion hasn't even happened yet.
Right.
You know, Arya and Jon haven't met. I don't know if they ever will, but
that's the one that I'm really wanting to see, because there should be no reason at all that they have any kind of enmity, and it should be the heartwarming one you're looking for. All right, let's move on to another recent book reader, Matt from San Francisco. I've decided to take the plunge and read all the books in the long winter until season 8. After blazing through a Game of Thrones, I stumbled on this gem in A Clash of Kings. Tyrion says to Varys, I used to dream that one day I'd be rich enough to send a faceless man after my sweet sister, which was from the 10th Tyrion chapter. I know Jaime's the favorite in the Valonqar sweepstakes, and he's still my bet, too, but if Tyrion hires or convinces Arya to kill Cersei in Season 8, which sounds like a double-D plot to begin with, wouldn't he be fulfilling the prophecy in the most Gurm way possible? Cersei would actually be kind of right for hating fearing him all her life, and at the very least, it'd give Arya something interesting for her to do at once. Plus, she's only said she's going to kill the queen like 100 times. Well, if you were really up in your Martin, you'd say half 100.
Only if he gives her his face to do it. That's what I want to see.
That would be well, I mean, Jamie's right there. Maybe because the guy's like, man, would that be a kick in the ass if like Tyrion commits suicide? Because like, there's no way to get close to Cersei because you know, the mountains there and all that, and you know, she's got to take Tyrion's face, or Tyrion commits suicide to let her have his face so she can go infiltrate the Red Keep and kill her.
Uh-huh.
I mean, look at me, writing fan fiction.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
It's not inconceivable.
I'd forgotten the interaction between Tyrion and Varys, and that is interesting, and the fact that like we know that Martin loves to embed that really deep stuff that second, third, fourth reads you don't see until later on it develops. You're like, oh God, look at the brilliance and the foresight and the foreshadowing.
And come on, Tyrion, you're not rich enough to send someone after your sister.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
I don't know if you can write a check that big. Because that's the thing about
he's
the
He's a Lannister.
Yeah, but that's the thing about the faceless men. They adjust based on
give
income.
Them Shay.
They pay
give
on a sliding
Shay
scale.
Give them Shay to do it. Here you go. Here's Shay. She's
They're
my...
like, oh, you're worth $1 billion? Well, the contract is for $900 million. But the fucking peasant only had to like give his third-born child. Well, that's peasant
pricing. I'm saying like, oh, take a look at Shay. She's the... thorn in my father's side that I value so much. Here you go.
They'd be like, that's not a payment. That's us taking your dirty laundry.
Yeah. In my mind, probably not in his.
Yeah. That would be an interesting way to fulfill it, though, because it kind of sort of fulfills the prophecy in a half-ass Arya's wearing the face of someone who could be a Valonqar Way. And also, it's both of their intentions, right? It's Tyrion wants it and Arya does it. And Arya obviously wants it because, she said she wants to kill Cersei a million times.
Do you think they're sending sort of mixed messages on Tyrion's intentions in these later seasons? Because I don't get the feeling that he so hates his sister at this point that he's willing to kill her. I almost get the feeling that, like, he's struggling with this idea of destroying his entire family.
Yeah, but how much of that is tied up with his feelings towards Jaime?
Most of it, for sure. But I think it's also, like, the dynasty sort of thing is in him as well. I don't know.
It's hard for me. I mean, my initial response when you said that is, no, I think he really would hate and kill Cersei at a moment's notice. It's just, the extinction of his line has to, weigh heavily on him. And, I mean, that's the thing, I have kids, but before I had them and I thought about, maybe not having kids, that was one thing that was like, man, what, isn't it weird that, my family line could be extinguished? Like, this last name, I could be the last of this, and it just dies out. That's like, you look at your family tree, and it goes all the way back to the monkey days. I mean, it's a stupid thing to think about, because in the grand cosmic scale, nothing means anything, so who gives a shit? But
you're not going to care about that when you're dead.
Yeah, and I'm like, if I'm Tyrion, and I got my finger on the button, and I can just make, this is the end. This is it. This is it for the Lannisters. Like, I guess... to the extent that it'd probably weigh even heavier on him, because I don't wake out of the bed giving a shit about the Hubbard line, whereas obviously Tyrion does. There's a lot of history there. All right. Hillary says, looks like the theory that was mentioned in this week's episode 2 recap spoiler section was confirmed today. Apparently they will be shooting multiple endings to try and thwart leaks and keep everyone guessing. Maybe not the same as putting out fake leaks, but they are actively trying to dupe people. I remember when I first read that article, we were sitting there getting ready for our club feature lunch with Jim and Aaron on Friday, and I said, guess what just came across my headline? Like, we had just got done, talking about it, there's no way they're going to go that expense.
Yeah.
They're going to fucking do it. And this was sent in by multiple people, Hillary's the first, multiple sources confirming that they are not just going to send out leaks, but they're going to be shooting multiple endings. Very reminiscent to... I guess that's what Lucas did with Empire Strikes Back, that the line he's told Luke was, Obi-Wan is your father, on set, and then they dubbed in James Earl Jones with the truth.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess if I was there on the scene, I'd be like, Luke is really overreacting to this revelation.
Right.
Like, Obi-Wan being his father is like that son, and then I guess the fact that Darth Vader killed his dad, I don't know. But he knew that. That's what Obi-Wan told him.
If you, tell Kit Harington, so in this scene, Kit, you're looking across. I know it's a green screen out there, but you're looking across and you see the white dragon just breathe frost fire all over, I don't know, Cersei Lannister.
Right.
And now we want you to act like this is the most devastating thing you've ever seen, Kit. Why? Why my character? That's not my character. I wouldn't care about that.
Or what?
Well, okay, we're really doing Sansa, but we want you to think it's Cersei.
All right, I'm gonna write podcast fan fiction. What if the Double D's heard our podcast where one of the listeners suggested this airplane style Valonqar prophecy where there's just people lined up to throttle Cersei, and it's not just one person's every popular suspect Jaime and Tyrion and they all take turns. What if
What did they film all that? Like,
they
there's
should.
Like 30 different characters just choking the shit out of Lena Headey. And
just release it as a bonus feature.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Blu-ray.
I haven't bought a Blu-ray. I think the last of the because the Blu-rays for Game of Thrones are spectacular.
They are, yeah.
But I couldn't justify getting them and watching the special features once and having them sit on my fucking shelf. Because I hate physical media. But I would buy the season 8 DVD if there was a supercut of 30 people strangling Cersei Lannister.
It'd be great.
That would be pretty sweet. But that, yeah. I mean, that would be like, you know, they could film like Jon betraying Dany betraying Jon. Like it's, I never think they would do it, but like if you were going to spend the money to do it, this is the one because it's the biggest show on television. This is what everyone's dying to know.
And it's the last season. I mean, that the finale
and you have,
of
that's
the series.
The and that's why I said you couldn't just disseminate fake leaks because mm-hmm. people would then see the actual filming locations like they do with their telephoto. If they actually film it, boy.
You don't know which one's going to make the cut.
It's Schrodinger's ending. You're never going to know until you... So I think it's brilliant, and I'm glad. Now, I'm glad that they're doing it. Now, I guess the meta conversation is how do we handle it? Like, if there's 30 leaks.
Yeah.
Do we just throw those in with the fan speculation or do we do another season where no, we don't talk about any kind of leaks regardless of knowing the fact that because
yeah, that's a good question.
You know,
I don't think I'll have an answer for that for a while. That's what I got to think about.
It's a good thing we got some time.
Yeah, I'm shocked that they're doing that though.
I am
like
too.
I really didn't think they were.
No, I mean obviously we
yeah.
You heard our honest reaction to the before the news hit and we were both like, yeah, it'd be nice. But there's no way.
For all the reasons, yeah.
And they're doing it. Jacinta, do you think Gendry and Arya end up together? Gendry being able to back her or bring her back down to Earth if she goes too far down the Faceless Man rabbit hole. In the first book, Ned tells Robert that his son and her daughter will be married. They are also shown to have a relationship on their way to the Wall in Season 2, Episode 2 as well. So I do like the fact that Ned telling Robert that their children will be married eventually comes true happily with Arya and Gendry. And I think Gendry's awesome. I think Arya's awesome. I think they're actually be a good match.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't think they see each other that way.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a little bit more evidence in the books that he, you know, like this whole My Lady stuff gets a little bit. But that's the thing. Like in the books, it's a lot easier to read in the dialogue. Things that are not there, whereas in the series, I'm just seeing an older brother and a little sister. So I don't think so. But I also wouldn't be completely fucking up in arms if, you know, as a classic, like, that's like, fucking happens all the time. Like, you have this, like, brother-sister relationship with the boy next door. Oh, never think of him that way. And then you go away for a summer and you come back and puberty's hit. And it's like... Oh my God, he's got abs now, and she's got this. she's got breasts, and so sure it can happen, but I don't know if it will. Next, Peter. During a series spoiler part, you read an email from a listener about how Jaime and Bronn will free Ellaria Sand in Game of Thrones season 8, then lead the Dornish army to fight the army of dead, and maybe Cersei. Sorry to burst your bubble, but in July 2017 issue of Entertainment Weekly, actress Indira Varma, who plays Arya, told them that she won't reappear on Game of Thrones after the Queen's Justice.
No, 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 not Arya.
What?
Ellaria.
Ellaria. I'm sorry, did I say... I
thought you said Arya. Maybe I misheard, but...
Okay, Ellaria. You're right, Ellaria. Indria Varma does not play Arya.
And we know that actors are not allowed to mislead or lie during interviews.
Oh, ho, ho. Peter says next. I know what you're going to say. Kit Harington basically said the same thing at the end of Game of Thrones Season 5, then poof! He's resurrected in season 6. We can't trust what actors...
Let me guess. Took another acting job.
but he says, I think that they are getting rid of secondary characters, and we only have 6 more episodes left. So they'll only be major characters from now on. I mean...
Yeah, if she needs to be important for the plot, she'll be there. If
that's
not,
the thing,
she
Peter.
Won't.
Like, I'm not... I think it's a cool theory that would also... Because there's a sense of fatalism amongst mainly the book readers that they're just fucking this shit up. They're just fucking this shit up. Like, fucking Dragonstone is abandoned. They've never heard of a Castilian. And, like, Dorne's just going to be forgotten about. And, like, part of me wants the double Ds to prove these guys wrong and recover from a few missed steps of this season and bring all this shit together with this big feature-length episode, Aladdin's season 8. So
it would make me happy to see, and I think it would make the book purist happy to be proven wrong, right? So, like, anything I can, any theory that would might, because someone really tore this theory apart in the forums. I forget their main thrust. But I had to concede, like, yeah, it doesn't. But on the other hand, the other thing I like about it is it also retroactively fixes some of the sins of season five. The fact that the Jaime and the Dorne and the Bronn plot, like, didn't really go anywhere. It was really kind of stupid. And
right.
The fact that they established that relationship would kind of retroactively make it cooler. Mm-hmm. So, like, when you're rewatching the whole series and you get to, like, man, I really thought this was shit. But, boy, when Bronn invaded the Red Keep and stole Ilaria and they combined led the armies of Dorne against this king, like, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I kind of want it to be true. I don't necessarily buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my straddling the fence answer. Travis M., do you guys think the wolf pack will return in season 8? I could see a scenario where the Stark Targaryen alliance has to flee the north and fall back to the Trident for the final battle with the White Walkers and the Army of the Dead. In that event, it could be likely that Nymeria and her wolves join the fight to defend Arya and others. Let's hope they do so to make up for leaving Ghost out of season 7 and to give us one more emotional reunion of the two remaining direwolves.
No, I really don't see a huge role for the wolves to play.
Yeah.
Ghost, maybe,
yeah.
Because Jon is so important to the plot, but...
Oh my god, the book... If they don't bring Ghost back in season
8... Yeah,
yeah. Like, I don't even think it's even the book readers at this point. Like, uh-huh. Ghost is a fan fucking favorite, and they have to know that, and...
Yeah.
You can't park him in Winterfell for the entire winter.
No, and Nymeria, I think, has had her send-off. The Arya-Nymeria reunion was nice. I don't know that they need to do any more with that to satisfy me. Not saying, again, that it won't happen. Just saying I don't think there's a real need for it.
I do think it would be super cool. Like, and I've always thought it'd be very cool if the Nymeria-led wolf pack does something to turn the tide of the war. Because the other thing they're really selling is that this is a near-run thing. Like, every soldier you lose is changing the balance of the power. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, we've gone from a 100,000 army in Westeros to having, like a 10,000 army being a big thing. I would like for that to be true, but I can't think of a plausible scenario that doesn't involve just writing fan fiction. Uh-huh. That would bring them back into play. Kevin C., I recall you joking about the White Walker's wordless gloating language in the show and how you like that the Night King doesn't speak. You reminded me that it seems in the books the others actually do have a spoken language. There are two quotes from the prologue in Game of Thrones. The other said something in a language that Will did not know. His voice was like the cracking of ice on a winter lake, and his words were mocking. Ah, see? Mocking, close kin to gloating. Also, Will closed his eyes. Far beneath him, he heard their voices and laughter sharp as icicles. Either way, almost all evidence of their communication really does seem to be some form of mocking. Do you think the show might still give the Night King a voice? I agree with you about his silence adding to his menace, but a part of me is kind of curious what they'd come up with.
I don't know. I was unaware that he spoke in the books in any kind of form.
Well, the Night King hasn't made himself visible in the books yet, but they do. They have this hint that they do have these voices, and I meant they. Okay,
yeah.
I also thought at the end of this episode they did a really good job of hinting at like this other maybe saying something, because it was more than just guttural animal noises, and it had like a lot of this sound design that reminds me of these passages in the book. But
yeah, and if they speak in like sounds of nature,
yeah,
how would you even know that they were talking? Maybe
subtitles.
Well, yeah, I don't think they're going to subtitle
like
Night King cracking snow and wilting ice.
Like, no, I said that as a joke, but I do think that like on the astral plane where, you know, Bran sometimes confronts the Night King, they could plausibly have a conversation where Bran is speaking English and the Night King responds in his language, and they would have subtitles, and you would intuit that Bran can understand them because they're kind of speaking mentally anyway. But I feel like
that very quickly turns into a Family Guy skit.
Yeah, I really like the poor Quentin's blog theory about Euron being like some kind of ends up being some attached to the others in some way. Like, that's a theory I still think has got a lot of promise. The fact that he's going to defect and switch sides and offer to somehow make himself in a play to make himself a demigod ends up being like a Locutus of Borg figure to the others, and then there you've got you know, like if like we've seen. It also is a nice symmetry with Benjen Stark. How that was like the vassal of the three-eyed raven. He's got a human that can speak and do things and have agency. Euron turned into an other would kind of be the other side of that coin.
Yeah.
So I it's a direct answer, Kevin, or your question, Kevin. I could see it both ways, either just subtitled where Bran and him are communicating, or through some kind of corrupted form of Euron.
It's a lot easier to convince Euron. There's no like skin grafting involved. Uh-huh. Data's a real tough one. Tough nut to crack if you're the Borg queen.
You're continuing the Star Trek reference? Sure.
Yeah, first
sure.
Contact.
She's just going to, the Night's King is going to blow on his forearm.
Uh-huh.
And that's all it takes. No obsidian required. Jackie Z, after listening to your last podcast, you guys jokingly brought up the idea that no one who claimed to stop watching after the show eclipsed the books really did. Yet my boyfriend has been a diehard book reader since about 2 years after the show, or pre-show. After it became clear at the end of season 5 that the show would pass the books and perhaps even finish them, he stopped watching. While he loves the show, he loves the books so much more, and he didn't want to be given half an ending. So my discussion topic is this. Though he avoids the Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire forums, subreddits, etc., he still managed to be spoiled for two major things, Jon's rebirth and Jon as a Targ, both things he assumed from the books. He's been pretty frustrated by this because he considers the book readers pretty good and not posting Ned's death, the Red Wedding, etc., while they were out there. while they're out there, they weren't plastered everywhere and this hard to avoid. My question is, how do you guys feel about this? I understand the show is a spectacle, but Jon's rebirth was on magazine covers. For a show fan base, this seems very sensitive to spoilers. It somehow seems hypocritical. As you mentioned, even r/A Song of Ice and Fire is very loose with show spoilers.
I mean, I don't think you can hold promotional materials and the media who is trying to cover a contemporary show to the same standards that you can hold your friends in a bar to. Like, don't fucking spoil this for me, bro. Like,
and also,
you can't tell EW that.
Here's the thing. If I think it's very rose-colored glasses to remember the book people being very considered the show watchers, because that sure as shit was not my experience.
Uh-huh.
And also, I think one of the reasons I decided to take the plunge and read the books after season one is because I was sick and tired of fucking book readers putting things as speculation as spoilers and me naively believing them.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, somebody has to play the goddamn referee. And I saw that again. Like there's this troll energy that lives in certain people where they just like doing that. And look at all the bullshit, like, guys filming their friends' reaction to the Red Wedding. Like, how many thousands of things that went on YouTube where it's like, you didn't think it was weird that someone pulled out your fucking phone and started filming your reaction 30 seconds into this scene?
Right.
Like, there was a lot of horseshit from the book readers. Even when it's benign, like I saw very common, where a show reader was trying to speculate on something and a book reader come in, "Oh, you sweet summer child."
Mm-hmm.
Like, go fuck. I mean, I'm not saying anything about your boyfriend. I'm sure he's a saint. And I understand his frustration. But it's interesting, almost like this is illuminative of like more serious issues in the world. Like, you pay attention to the virtues of your side and you're completely ignorant of the vices. And both sides do that. So you've got this endless cycle of like, well, those fuckers did it to us, so we're going to do it to them. Well, fuckers did it to us, we're going to do it to them. And it just never ends. So,
our points are very inflammatory, obviously.
We're
half joking here.
But
the more measured response is, you're taking your life into your hands, man. Like,
well,
if you really don't want spoilers and you refuse to engage on the same timeline as everyone else, you're taking a risk. You know, if that's your thing, don't spoil me. You either have to watch contemporary with everyone else, so you can't be spoiled, or you have to accept that there's the possibility you might get spoiled on this.
But more to her boyfriend's point, the thing I do feel sorry for him, and I don't think that he's obviously one of the assholes who's trying to spoil stuff. But what I do feel sorry for is like those book readers and the other people that were intentionally, gleefully, and trollingly spoiling people. They didn't have major publishing. They weren't the CEO of a major publishing house.
Right.
they didn't own a media company. They weren't pumping the shit over, like, because you could realistically avoid spoilers, book spoilers, but it's very hard to avoid, like, the Night King is going to be riding a fucking ice dragon on next year's Entertainment Weekly.
Right.
And you're shopping, and you're at the checkout aisle, and your iPad is like, fuck. Like, I feel, for, as much as this is a fairly non-serious thing to complain about, I feel for you, because it is a bummer. And you can't avoid it. It's the biggest fucking show in the world.
Right. There's no way you're going to change the climate of media.
The only way you could avoid it is to go into a cabin in the mountains and never go to the store, order everything off Amazon, and stay off the radio and the internet and TV for the next 3 years. And even then, I wouldn't put it past Bezos to put the Ice King riding an ice dragon on a box for a promotional feature. Right. So when you order your toothpaste, God damn it! God damn it! I did it! I did it all! I did it all! It's just like Aaron said. So,
yep.
What are you going to do? But I don't like the hypocrisy. That's way overblown, because there's bloodshed on both sides. All right. Anything else you want to say?
Nope.
Moving on to Cody S. Would Game of Thrones be better without the White Walkers? explosive hot take,
man. I don't know. I mean, I love season two, and season two is all about the politics and the human confrontations here. It's not about the White Walkers so much.
That's
true of all early Game of Thrones, but I don't think it is a worse show because they're introducing these fantastic elements. Like, if it had started from day one with ice dragons and magic walls and White Walkers, I probably wouldn't have ever gotten into it. But now that I am into it and the show is changing a little bit, I don't find myself going, man, I wish this was really still the old show.
Yeah.
Except when I feel like they're shortchanging the show to do those things.
And you know, that's, like, unfortunately, I think they had to do that last season.
A little bit last season, right. The conversations were maybe cut a little bit short. They didn't quite have everything structured out the way I would want in favor of, like, these big fantastical scenes.
Yeah.
So, you know, in as much as that, if they can keep that from getting in the way of telling a good story,
right,
then I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit of a hindsight bias, because to the extent that the others seem to be the problem that makes the other stuff not working, like, oh, the dumbest plot revolved around how to convince Cersei to believe in a threat of the others. Like, I don't think it's a de facto, like, you can say, like, well, there you go, White Walkers are a problem. I think it's the way they were handled, is if there is a problem, is the problem. And also, I mean, George is trying to say something about humanity's ability to ignore larger problems in favor for smaller, more petty ones that are directly in front of their faces, and their refusal to deal. And this is stuff like, I mean, that's a commentary on, like, we talked about, like, you know, global warming. It's a commentary about the things that caused World War One to happen. It's a commentary about a lot of different things. And if the White Walkers are not there, all that commentary goes away. And that's one of the, you know, like, that's like saying, you know, the Lord of the Rings was dumb because it was J.R.R. Tolkien wanted to say too much about the industrial world taking over agriculture and industrialized warfare. And, like, I mean, that's what he wanted to say, man.
Yeah.
So, like, if George is like, ah, this is a stupid idea, I don't want it, like, he wouldn't have wrote the story that you think was better. And also,
yeah, that's fair.
And also, the evidence, we just don't know, like, the evidence isn't all in about whether this is a fatal problem. And even if it was, you could always argue that it was execution, not the idea. So, I'm one of the ones that I always thought it was super cool that you had this grounded, realistic world that was having the rug pulled out from underneath it. And, like, Cersei mocking the threat of the others is an entirely rational act. And I think, I love that. We can see it's a disaster, but that's the one thing. Like, you can say a lot of shit about Cersei Lannister, but that's a rational call. That's something that a smart person would do. It's something Tyrion would do, if not for, and he doesn't fully. I love his performance there in that small council scene, because his wheels are rotating furiously, because he's like, fucking dick. But why would Mormont lie?
Yeah,
like, he's not a guy that just wants men for the sake of having men.
The Night's Watch has been shorthanded for generations. Why? So I think that adds a little spice. If the execution is a problem, then and maybe it is, but the idea is sound, I think.
I think 7 years ago when the show first started, I would have given you a much different answer.
What would you say?
It would have been, fuck fantasy, I don't want anything to do with that.
Right.
And I think that's because I've seen my history with fantasy has been like just fantasy for fantasy's sake, and a lot of just convoluted fantasy bullshit for the sake of it. Whereas Game of Thrones has done it in such an elegant way, mixing, you know, the things that I cared about in a story with the things that fantasy cares about in a story.
Yeah.
I think it's changed my mind on a lot of fantasy, and I still don't want to read bad fantasy. I don't want to watch bad fantasy, but if you can do fantasy well, I think it's got its place.
It's so weird because, like, I want to fight you because I know the most of the fantasy experience you're talking about is, like, Lord of the Rings, which is, like, one of the gold standards.
Right, but come on. Come fucking on, man.
I ain't gonna come on.
With all the fucking songs that just, like, start up book and the, here's elves and goblins and dragons.
But
and
you never got that far, right? You never tried to read Lord of the Rings.
I tried to read The Hobbit. And I stopped that fucking book like a chapter or two in.
When did you read it?
I was probably 12.
Okay.
It was a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, because I feel like The Hobbit's intended audience is like 6 to 10. And like Lord of the Rings is very much like it's the coolest fucking thing if you're reading as a 13-year-old.
But it wasn't just like a dumb kid story.
But even
it
then,
was more like all the names and places.
No, I get
and, like,
it.
All that
I,
shit.
I get
just
it. Like
I
thought we were talking about the movies, and I'm like, how the fuck can you say something bad about the movies?
No. I
because
love the
it,
movies.
It takes all the core awesome stuff and dispenses with the more literary things. Because even I, as a 13-year-old nerd primed for loving that shit, got to like the Council of Elrond and like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me with this shit?
Yeah.
So
it's a little indulgent, we'll say.
All right.
But Game of Thrones has been great.
Because that's the thing. Like, I'd have a hard time recommending any fantasy to you.
Yeah. So I've got this Patrick Rothfuss, Name of the Wind. Is that the one?
Kvothe. So I haven't read that. The reason I haven't read that is because I've heard from even fans that like the wheels kind of fall off in later books.
Oh, shit. Okay, so, well, I'm going to give the first book a try. I haven't got into it yet.
And I do tend to hate, like, a lot of the other, like, people love Wheel of Time. I've tried to read Wheel of Time 3 times, and I can't even get past the first book.
Yeah, I hear that's a tough one.
And, like, another, like, the Mistborn, Bryan Sanderson, like, that's his gold standard. And, like, I enjoyed it, but I thought that the books progressively got worse as they went on. Like, the thing that really recommends it is its magical system. It's like the anti-Game of Thrones. What recommends it is magical system and how tight it is.
Right.
His characters are very thin, young adult bullshit for the most part. Nah. So this has been your fantasy talk.
Yeah.
Fantasy Corner with Jim and Aaron. If you'd like to subscribe to, well, no, because you wouldn't. It's terrible.
Yeah, just give me the good fantasy and I'm okay with it.
I just don't know. Like I said, it's like someone say, I hate anime, and I'm like, okay, we'll watch Grave of the Fireflies and Akira and
Cowboy Bebop
and fucking Full Metal Alchemist, and you're like, nah, it's still shit. Like, show me the good stuff. I'm like, you might just hate you might just hate anime.
Right.
I hate country music. Well, here's some Johnny Cash and here's some some George Jones. It's shit. You might honestly just hate country.
Yep.
So, all right. If you got feedback, you can send it in to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com Also, the forums and social media, just like I said on the not, it applies. I don't even know why I'm doing it. It's not a separate podcast.
No, it's all the same thing.
We'll be back for episode 3 next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya. Passport to Hulk.
Passport to Hulk.
Are you familiar with the old Incredible Hulk show from like the late 70s, early 80s?
Sure. The whole pants ripping journey.
Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah. The pants never ripped. The pants tattered.
Pants tattered. They don't rip because having a giant green schlong, we had to get to the aughts before we could deal with the giant blue schlong in the form of Dr. Manhattan. So the concept of that show, as I remember it, is you had this guy, it was David Banner. I think they changed it for some reason to David instead of Bruce. But anyway, David Banner, he's an Incredible Hulk, and he has to wander from town to town because he eventually gets angry and is revealed to be a rage monster, and then they play the sad music and he kicks his can down the road. It's been a long time since that show came out.
It has.
Uh, poor David has been to every major metropolitan and rural community in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there's just big, you know, where you get welcome to Logansport, Louisiana, and population 3,429. And there's a giant green Hulk face with an international no sign.
Okay.
Hulk's gotta take his road show on the road. He's got to go to foreign countries.
This is a the United States is some sort of isolationist future that you're cooking up here that they don't know about the Hulk in other countries. When he's
right.
literally done the American tour across the nation.
He's set the entire continental plus Alaska and Hawaii.
Oh shit!
Plus Hawaii.
What about Canada and Mexico? Has he gone to all those?
He needs a passport. Because this is post 9/11, you can't.
How did he get to
Alaska?
You can't
just bop over the Canadian border anymore.
Can you fly to Alaska without a passport? Well,
of course.
Really?
It's still the United States. You could fly Puerto Rico. He's gone through Puerto Rico.
Okay.
He's gone through Guam.
Uh huh.
He's gone through the American Samoas. He's mm-hmm. every place. It's all doors have been shut to him. He's now got to take his road. Like what? And now, but now there's language barriers.
Mm-hmm.
There's the like.
There's the frustration.
I can't fucking plug my hair dryer in, and like just everything. Like he doesn't even get to the part where he rights a wrong. It's just
right. It's just every day.
Hulk drive on wrong side of road. Ah! You know.
I mean, even getting there has got to be a challenge, right? With the annoyances
of
the TSA, airport security.
You want to pat me down for? Are you putting your hands in my pants? What the fuck?
Right.
And yeah, like he doesn't even make it out of the airport.
I'm picturing a scene where they're patting him down and they get to the crotch and he's so fed up with it at that point that
right.
he's hulking out and they don't notice. Like
right.
the guy patting him down doesn't notice until
right.
he gets to the schlong, which just starts growing. He's like, sir, sir, you can't. And he looks up and suddenly the Hulk's there.
Right.
Smashing him.
Right. It's like the international airports are on lookout for men in purple pants. Like they're detained for special.
Going?
No, I just like. I mean, that's a truism. Every fucking time Lou Ferrigno got it there in his green body paint, he had those tattered purple pants on. So I assume...
Yeah, it's like a Joker
David
motif.
Banner just wore purple pants.
Yeah. I mean, it was disco era, right?
It's a nice high contrast color, green and purple.
Yeah. When that show came out, it was Bell Bottom City, right?
Right. And
I mean,
wouldn't
there
they
were
just
a lot
revoke,
of
wouldn't they just revoke
there?
His passport? Or maybe the U.S. is so happy to get him out that they're like aiding and like they're just
yeah
giving,
yeah they're pushing him off on other
your
countries.
Your real name is Bruce. You're not David. Get the fuck out of here. Don't
that was
come
the
back.
Pseudonym you took so that we wouldn't find you. We found you. Now get out. But other countries won't take him. Right? He gets there. He gets extradited back.
Yeah. Every single
to
time
America.
He every single time you know so he asks where to go to bathroom and no one understands.
Mm-hmm.
And he shits his he shits his pants and hulks out. They're like, all right, get you know you've done $5 billion of damage at Dubai. Get out.
Our sewer systems are very very old here. They're not equipped for your
shits. They're not equipped for an incredible shit.
Yeah.
No, they're not equipped. The water pressure can't deal with an incredible shit.
Right, passport to Hulk. I'd watch it.
I would too. And the fact that it's the longest running TV show in America at this point is
it would have to be.
respect.